Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are once again. It's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. That's an email address for questions related to health and nutrition. All aspects of medicine are covered, and each week we get a wide variety of great questions, and we endeavor to answer them together. I'm with Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence. We work together daily here in Midtown Manhattan at my practice to help patients with medical and nutritional problems, and we're going to endeavor to do so in this podcast. So how are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Terrific.
And, of course, we are in the aftermath of a terrible shooting incident, and because of the nature of our recording schedule, some of this information may be a little dated because it's a developing story.
Yes.
But we recorded this literally within a couple of days of the incident, which I believe happened on Monday. So earlier this week. So because we podcast a little bit ahead of schedule, some of the information may actually even be further developed.
Yes.
But the latest finding, you know, as we try to discover the motives of this killer, is that he was taking, or very likely, under the as of now, the toxicology tests aren't in, but they may be in by the time of this broadcast. But he was known to have been a user of a medication called diazepam, better known as Valium. And so there's a, you know, whenever these episodes occur, everybody seizes upon them with an agenda. You know, the people who want gun control, they seize with seize upon the incident. And, you know, rightly so, because it's terrible that, people can obtain weapons of such terrible mass destruction. And we want to do something about that. And then there are people who say that he was trying to target Trump supporters. So these are people who are saying that this is a an emanation of left-wing hate. So this is, they're appropriating the event to their agenda. And then there are the people who are vociferously anti-drug, who say that it's the drugs that made him do it. And I don't want to, you know, trivialize the argument because this is an act of pure evil, clearly. But there is an important dimension to this, which is that several of the mass killings that we've seen have been in individuals who are taking medications.
Psychiatric medications.
Now you say,
specifically.
Now you might say, well, crazy people do crazy things and then they're on psychiatric medications. But there is an argument to be made that when you are an angry individual and you take a psychiatric drug, there is a possibility of what's called disinhibition. And disinhibition means that you inhibit that part of your brain that either through fear or conscience prevents you from doing something really, really horrendous.
Yeah.
So no fear, no conscience, and we can take anger and turn it into a mass killing event. And this has actually been documented in the psychiatric literature.
Yeah. And more people, more and more people are being prescribed these particular medications. From what I've read so far, yes, he suffered with an anxiety disorder. He didn't sleep well. Addicted to gambling, but again, these are early
which
reports.
Which is a sign of obsessive compulsive disorder, you know,
right.
Some sort of psychiatric propensity.
Mm-hmm.
Father was a psychopath, bank robber, interestingly.
Oh my.
Yeah, and a diagnosed psychopath. But I'm sharing with you an article that's actually somebody sent me on Facebook after I posted the article, and it's from the British Journal of Psychiatry. And it is a formal psychiatric study entitled Benzodiazepines and Disinhibition, a Review. And they say the overall incidence of disinhibitory reactions is small, but those with multiple those with impulse control problems, neurological disorders, learning disabilities, the under 18s and the over 65s are at significant risk.
Wow.
And they're at risk for what is disinhibition? Well, a drug can have the potential to both decrease and increase aggressive behavior depending on the underlying characteristics of the person who consumes it. It's like, think of when, you know, how people smoke pot. You know, some people sort of get giggly and, you know, and other people kind of get quiet and maybe anxious and paranoid.
Hungry.
And hunger is common. But, you know, I'm talking about psychological reactions. Yes. Similarly to alcohol, you know, you have these sort of loud, rambunctious drunks. And then this sort of, you know, sort of quiet people. And it sort of brings out the tendencies with disinhibition. So it says, in the majority of recipients, benzodiazepines have a calming effect, but in a minority, they can cause paradoxical reactions, also called disinhibitory reactions, characterized by acute excitement and an altered mental state. Increased anxiety, vivid dreams, hyperactivity, sexual disinhibition, hostility, and rage.
Oh my.
So if this is not...
Quite the combination.
Right. You know, they say alcohol consumption is known to increase feelings of hostility and competitive and retaliatory behavior. Obviously, barroom brawls, you know.
Yeah.
And they say that alcohol is involved in over 50% of acts of violence. But there are case reports and studies that suggest that the use of benzodiazepines, which include Valium, can be associated with unleashing super aggressive tendencies. And turning you into effect into a stone cold killer.
Right. Oh wow! I know that school shootings, these drugs have been implicated to some degree. Certain famous musicians who have committed suicide. Chris Cornell was on anti-anxiety medications, and I remember as a personality, you'd say, That's not a guy who's going to kill himself.
Right, and that's what that's what the wife said. That's what the wife said. It's just not him because
that's not him.
But maybe in an altered state,
yes,
you become inured to the pain and the danger of, you know, taking your life. I mean, it's to me, you know, I have a great deal of self-preservation about me, and you know, so much so that I don't want to jump out of an airplane and do skydiving.
Me either.
But you know, maybe if I took a couple of Valiums, I would be a little, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or had a bottle of something to drink, some kind of alcohol. Well, yeah.
Do a couple of tequila shots. Yeah.
No. Exactly. So,
in other words, another way of saying it is, hold my beer. You know that expression.
Oh my!
You know that expression, yeah? Right.
Yeah.
It's like let me just watch me try this.
Okay. Right. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but so anyway, so it's interesting speculation, and again, it's you know, I think in some ways it's disrespectful and sort of trivializes a horrible event to try and hitch an agenda to it. And my views on psychiatry, modern psychiatry, is that I am not inalterably opposed to psychiatric medications. There's a place for them.
Sure.
And they help certain people. But
yes.
I think we have a society where we have an overdependence on medications. And I just, for example, I just worked with a patient who I've been seeing for 20 years. When I first saw her, she was on 6 to 8 Ativans a day. This is, you know, the patient. We have this patient in common.
Yes.
She only today, I mean, only last week, was able to inform me that it took her 20 years of work to get off her addiction to this Ativan, which is a related medication.
Wow. Yes. Another.
And she's, and it's been very hard because every time she's reduced it, she's had tremendous rebound anxiety and insomnia and physical symptoms. Very highly addictive medications.
Wow.
So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what materializes as we do it. What's called a forensic psychology on this guy. It's like, the guy's dead. You can't interview him. But, you know, you can try and piece together through his writings and his emails and interviews with people who knew him and, you know, maybe doing blood tests to see what's in his body. What's going on. Look at his brain, maybe. I don't know.
Another medication, I remember you just, somebody was taking an anti-malaria medication, a very old one,
yes,
you said to
me.
Yes, well, and you said that may be a cause.
Well, that was another, that was implicated in violence by returning GIs, because they took a type of anti-malarial medication that's now uncommonly used, but it is associated with psychosis as a side effect. And, you know, potentially acts of disinhibition and mm-hmm. violence, you know, changing the personality of an individual such that they would commit acts of violence. So, you know, these medications, you know, solve problems, but sometimes at a cost.
At a cost, yes. Well,
And the natural methods we continually discuss, you know, we've discussed, mm-hmm. and I wrote a recent article about natural treatment of anxiety, then natural treatment of depression, and how you've written how depression's an inflammatory disorder in the brain, and so on.
For you coffee drinkers out there and you're anxious, try stopping your coffee. Just try it. That would be the first thing.
I'll drink to that.
But you drink decaf.
I guzzled decaf.
Decaf is fine. I'm talking about high test. Mm-hmm. And then people find that their anxiety may diminish, unstable blood sugar issues. You know, all of these would be reasons for anxiety, barring and aside from the medication aspect.
Here's the value of the nutritional consultation. I've been seeing this patient that we saw today for quite a long time. And he comes today complaining of fatigue and anxiety. And then you come and you tell me, that he goes out every night and shares splits a bottle of wine
right.
with his wife.
Yes.
Because he enjoys it. It's, you know, he's retired and he's, you know, kind of mm-hmm. smelling the roses.
Right.
And, but that doesn't help.
No, it does not. And, I explained to him, a few times over that you really need to try and stop that. I know that the initial, for anybody who's anxious, that glass of wine or that cocktail can be like, can feel like a godsend. Because it helps you to decompress. But really, over time, what it's really doing is destabilizing your blood sugar, burning through your magnesium and your B vitamins, which is precisely what you need for anxiety, messing with your sleep, raising your cortisol. He also has a blood pressure issue. And that's because the cortisol is too high, not just from his anxiety, but from the alcohol.
Alcohol causes sort of rebound production of
cortisol.
Cortisol.
That middle of the night wake up.
And epinephrine.
Which is
adrenaline.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So anyway, so, you know, a lot of ways that we can get ourselves bent out of shape. We don't all buy 50 combat weapons and rig them to go on automatic fire and take out scores of individuals.
But videotape yourself doing it.
Yeah. And videotape ourselves doing it. But in some ways, we can distort our moods.
Oh, yeah.
At the very least.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get to questions.
All right. We've got an email from Ben. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I love your show and appreciate all the help you've provided to your listeners. My child is 9 and has been diagnosed by his pediatrician with moderate athlete's foot on the soles of his feet. The doctor prescribed Lotrimin. We've used it for 3 weeks and it hasn't helped. His feet are kept clean and dry with numerous daily sock changes. We spray the shower floor with Lysol. Regardless, the itching is so bad he has to use a fork to scratch it.
Well, what's going on with the kid? We know that the hygiene is really good externally. What's happening to the kid's internal hygiene when it comes to diet? Do we have any indication?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We actually don't.
So, you know, we being nutritionists, we're going to take a nutritional perspective on that. And I can virtually guarantee that we can do better with this kid's diet.
Yeah. A typical 9-year-old is not going to be probably a huge vegetable eater or more prone to snacking.
I'm thinking more sugar.
Sugar, yeah.
I'm thinking that, you know, sugar consumption is a factor here. Mm-hmm. So I think it's worth considering a nutritional perspective. Now, the other thing that's happening is that the immune systems of kids up until the time of puberty are not as robust as the immune systems of adults,
mm-hmm.
Or adolescents even. So what can happen is that you can have a kid, especially a kid on a poor diet, who has a chink in their immune armor, which allows the proliferation of fungus
mm-hmm.
and fungal species.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we might take a look at the kid's nutritional status, give them some additional nutrients that support immunity, particularly vitamin D.
Yes, vitamin D.
Check that.
Vitamin C. Olive leaf. Mm-hmm. Olive leaf soap might be another thing.
Yes.
You could kind of go the wrong way if you're overwashing and drying your feet, and mm-hmm. that dryness can cause itching.
You sort of deprive, what you're doing in effect is you are destroying the microbiome of the feet. Yeah. You know, there's a natural microbiome. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's been distorted, and you've got, a predominance of fungal species there where they don't belong. But
they spray the shower floor with Lysol. I want to know how often.
Not great. Potentially an irritant.
Irritant, yeah.
And also, all that disinfecting.
You're disinfecting his feet.
Yeah, it creates and that could create more bacterial resistance, you know, which could be part of complicating the picture.
Okay. Perhaps topical Lamisil is a newer and better antifungal, but would it be safe in children? Lamisil, I know the oral one can be hard on the liver.
That's, probably okay. But okay. I mean, other things that are helpful, tea tree oil.
Yes, they've been trying that, but only in the last few days. Okay. So, Ben, let us know.
Yeah.
But wow, don't overdo it with the Lysol. Don't overdo it with the washing and drying.
Yeah.
Drying, yes, you want them dry, but overdo it with the washing. Okay.
And it might be worth bringing the kid to a nutritionally oriented, a complementary practitioner for an evaluation.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even a dermatological consult in case it's not athlete's foot. I'm just throwing that out there.
Oh, this is. They're getting all this medication without seeing a dermatologist?
No, they're seeing a pediatrician.
Oh, pediatrician. Maybe they, yeah. In other words, the pediatrician is using the basic tools. Maybe a specialist might
uncover more. Okay. Mm-hmm. That could be something. Oh, Ben, best of luck to your son. Dr. Hoffman, what about Manuka?
Oh, Manuka is also has antifungal properties.
Antifungal,
yeah. Manuka oil. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the basis for that is it's from a New Zealand plant or an Australian plant, I think New Zealand, which has antifungal properties.
Right.
And Manuka honey is anti-infective.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'm thinking about for a 9-year-old, if you have gym class and you have showers and common locker room facilities, it's probably good to wear a pair of slippers or keep your socks on or something.
I try to do that in the gym. Yeah,
yeah, that might be something.
But I actually think it's more. You know, the question is it the microbe or the terrain?
Ah.
And I think the terrain rules here because I think some people get it and some people don't.
That's right.
And it depends a little bit on the underlying soil for the microbe, which they're ubiquitous and certainly in a locker room setting they're there for them to take hold. And I have to say that since I've been on a really good diet and I had these problems too when I was a kid, but I was on a, pretty oblivious diet.
Yeah. Kid diet.
Yeah. Yeah.
A kid diet. Oh, okay. Best of luck to you, Ben. All right. Dr. Hoffman, what are your thoughts on ozone therapy? Are there any significant risks? This comes from Rachel.
Well, yeah, there got to be significant risks with a therapy that essentially gives you the potential for free radicals in your body. The number one proponent in the U.S. of this is Dr. Robert Rowan, who is a very bright physician, and I respect him a lot. And he seems to feel that ozone therapy is wonderful for a variety of conditions. However, I had been involved, maybe 25 years ago or 30 years ago in administering ozone therapy. And
what did you think of the results back then?
I thought that the results were unclear.
Okay.
Unclear. I did not see, curing HIV, curing hepatitis. Mm-hmm. I think it was something we could do before they were good medications for HIV and before they were curative medications for hepatitis, which they now are.
Yeah.
So is it helpful for chronic fatigue syndrome, which may be caused by Epstein-Barr. I mean, that's a little bit like hitting a Swiss watch with a hammer, on the hopes that maybe it's going to, repair it. It's in Germany, it's quite well developed and there's a whole protocol for administering it. I went to Germany to look at the practitioners doing it and study it. I really wasn't impressed that much with their rigor. They seemed to rave about it, but I wasn't sure that the results were that tangible. For a variety of conditions, for cancer, they would do it rectally for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. With reported anecdotal benefits, but the studies are not really coming in that robust. And for something that, invasive, I would hope that there would be better documentation of the benefits.
What do you think of using ozone instead of chlorine in a swimming pool?
Oh, I think it's a great idea, right? Because at least, I mean, there, you know, it's not in your bloodstream.
Right.
And it kills everything. It kills all the bad stuff. And the other thing that ozone does is it detoxifies. It actually breaks down toxins.
Hmm.
And part of the problem in pools is not just the chlorine. It's the chlorine. And I read an article about this, kind of gross, is they estimated the amount of pee that was in a pool, and it's
yes.
a lot.
It's
and
a lot.
Some of it comes from kids, but some of it comes from the professional athletes and amateur athletes who, they're in the pool so long that they're just used to peeing in the pool. You know, it's the part of the culture is you pee in the pool. And so that's a big pool, you know. I mean, if you pee in the, you know, in the Atlantic or the Pacific, I mean, there's a lot of water there, right?
Yes.
But a pool is a confined, you know,
right.
area. And, you know, still a lot of gallons of water, but there, you know, you're going to release some organic matter into there. And mm-hmm. that organic matter combines with the chlorine and forms very, potentially toxic compounds.
Mm-hmm.
So what ozone does is it actually it's so strong that it breaks these compounds and sort of dissolves them away. It's a very purifying agent.
Mm-hmm.
But if you inhale it, it's toxic. You know, it's damaging the lungs, and that makes me worried when you inject it into the bloodstream.
Right, okay.
So I kind of backed away from that therapy, you know, years ago.
Mm.
What's interesting is that intravenous vitamin C works a little bit like ozone therapy in the sense that you generate high levels of hydrogen peroxide in the tissues.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about hydrogen peroxide is that there is a mechanism to neutralize it by normal cells, but cancer cells can't.
Mm.
And cancer cells are vulnerable to the effects of hydrogen peroxide, whereas normal cells, I mean, at the levels that we see with intravenous vitamin C, are spared. So, in effect, when we have intravenous vitamin C as a more well-studied and characterized oxidative therapy for treating infections and treating cancer, not sure why we need to go to ozone therapy. But I'm open to, you know, I wish there was more research. I keep looking for new people investigating ozone, but there's much more research on intravenous vitamin C than ozone.
Because it's more promising.
But ozone is still being used. But
you
know, that's the disturbing part is that it's trendy.
Yeah.
But it's more anecdotal results.
Mm-hmm. So the rigor isn't quite there. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Rachel, we hope that answers your question.
Yeah, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what we're going to be talking about in part two.
About your recent podcast, Dr. Hoffman, about soy and breast cancer, how do you reconcile the fact that the late Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez says soy is the most powerful food agent that destroys valuable enzymes that we need for defense against cancer?
Okay, let's tackle that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Layla Mutin, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla.